Last week, the U.S. Department of Justice sued the state of Georgia. The DOJ alleges Georgia segregates and mistreats thousands of public school students. The kids are enrolled in a statewide program called GNETS. It serves students with behavior-related disabilities. The Justice Department's lawsuit is the first to go after a state-run school system for segregating students with disabilities. Debbie Tucker of Parent to Parent Georgia told CBS 46 in Atlanta that all children have a right to interact with one another.
Here we are in 2016, and we're still fighting for the basic rights that have been assured under law for centuries. And now it really is taking DOJ to step in and go, Georgia, you have to come into compliance.
Last year, Adam Ragusa talked with Marion Wang. She investigated the GNETS program for ProPublica. Adam also spoke with Natasha Hall, whose son is in GNETS. Here's that conversation.
Firstly, Marion, just tell us, how does the GNETS program work?
So GNETS is a separate network that serves every one of the school districts in Georgia. And you know, it's usually the schools themselves that are sort of making these referrals saying this child belongs in GNETS. And so that's how there are 5,000 kids in GNETS. What they're intended to do is provide an education and some specialized support services for these kids and to, you know, really give them the support they need both on the behavioral front, but also to move them forward in their education.
And to be clear, they go to separate facilities, right?
Separate facilities. Sometimes, you know, it's a different separate wing of the same building. But, you know, the DOJ hit Georgia very hard on some of these GNETS facilities. You know, even in the same building, you have kids using separate entrances. You have kids using separate restrooms. You have kids, you know, with completely different lunch times. These children just never interact in a lot of cases with their peers who do not have disabilities.
And as I understand it, one of the reasons why the Justice Department is involved here is that the law says that schools are obligated to try to serve kids in the most integrated way possible, right?
Yeah, I mean, the special education law is that kids need to be educated in the least restrictive environment. And so that they consider that to be, you know, a really serious thing and possibly a violation of the IDEA and the ADA. And so there's a lot for the feds to sort of look into, and often this happens as a result of the Office of Civil Rights getting a lot of complaints from families and advocates.
What kind of instruction do kids get in these separate programs?
Well, so according to the DOJ report, they were finding that particularly at the middle school and high school level, you had these kids sort of sitting in front of computers doing computer-based instruction. So they didn't even have any teachers in some of these classrooms.
Wow.
And, you know, at the lower level, There were a lot of teachers who aren't certified to teach in the subjects that they're teaching. They hit them pretty hard on some of these issues of just the education not being the same, the instruction not being at the level that these kids need. And often it's a result of these kids not being really grouped with their specific grade. You know, you have kids that are sort of mixed in these facilities across different grades.
Which might be a necessity, right, when you consider that I imagine these programs are very small.
In some cases, yeah. I think it depends on the region. It's split into 24 regions in Georgia.
Hmm. Okay. So what else is the DOJ alleging?
Well, so one of the most striking things to me was that the DOJ essentially said most of the kids in here, nearly all of them, don't need to be here. They don't need to be in the segregated setting. If your neighborhood schools would just provide them more support rather than sort of at the first, you know, instance or incident, you know, they found that after a lot of the time, these recommendations that a child be placed in GNETS, that was occurring after one incident or a string of minor incidents. The example they gave was using inappropriate language with a teacher. And so if these mainstream sort of neighborhood schools were less quick to sort of shuttle the kid out of there after one incident or a couple incidents, a lot of these kids could be provided the right support in their neighborhood school setting, in an integrated setting, with just more support and with more flexibility, with teachers sort of understanding that inclusion is a value that we have.
Natasha Hall in Smyrna, your son started middle school. He has been in the GNETS program for several years now. He started in kindergarten, I think you said. How did he end up there?
It's funny she said in minor incidents. He ended up there in kindergarten because within the second week of school, I remember getting a phone call that he was asked to sit in timeout or rest down area, and he was having an emotional breakdown. He was crying. He was not listening. He was yelling. I came up to the school. I found him sitting there, and he was doing just that. No one could tell me why. No one could tell me what triggered it, any of that. And then probably about a week later, I was told that he was non-compliant. And when I asked why he was non-compliant, they said he didn't follow directions. And again, this is a kindergartner. This is like a five-year-old that they were telling me this about. And at that point, I found myself in a meeting with counselors and the principal and teachers that they considered a team. And they wanted to start developing an IEP and declared him EBD, which is a...
IEP is like a... What is it called? Individualized in education program? Is that what that means?
Correct. Correct.
Okay. So basically, you know, they called you in and they said, listen, your kid's a problem and we need to have a conversation about it because kindergartners never have emotional outbursts or are uncompliant.
Correct.
Sorry to make a joke out of it, but it can seem silly. Did you have to consent to your son being put into the GNETS program?
Well, what they did was they never explained to the parents, and I've sat in a number of IEPs with different parents. They never came out and said, hey, this is a GNETS program. This is what you're consenting to. What they actually state to us and what's given to us on paper, and we later find out as we go on through the years and the programs and get more knowledge about it, then we find out it's actually a GNETS program. They actually come to the table and tell us, hey, your kid has this this problem, and they usually declare it ADHD, or they'll just give us emotional behavior disorder, which qualifies him under IDEA to receive services and eligibility in this classroom. And we've been segregated in a classroom since kindergarten.
Right. So they basically just kind of say, hey, come this way. We're going to give your kid everything that he needs without saying exactly what that means. What's
Correct.
His experience been like?
I've watched my kid go from a normal kid to a human being that's depressed. He cries every day to go to school. When we pull up in the school, he tells me he hates this place. Why does he have to go? He refers to it often as a jail or the people hate him. He's stupid. He's weird. My son was full of life before I moved to Georgia and put him in the school system here. And now I literally sit and watch my son tear himself apart every day.
I'm so sorry to hear about your experience. Is there a way that you could get him into a mainstream school again?
We're fighting for that now. My prayer is yes. But as of right now, the team, in which the team usually consists of maybe six or more people, so my little voice, even though I'm the parent, really doesn't matter because everyone else that's involved in the school says different. And as long as they say different, I mean, my vote is nothing.
Right. Well, in a statement, Cassandra Allen Hollifield of the North Metro GNETS in Atlanta says this. They say, without GNETS, local school districts would be tasked with building similar programs that offer the services that GNETS provides, even if the district only required the services for two students. Districts would likely be unable to provide a program with as many supports and services as GNETS currently offers. Additionally, without the GNETS program, there are many students who would be served in much more restricted environments, including residential placements. So that's the perspective from one GNETS program. Well, Leslie Lipson is an attorney at the Georgia Advocacy Office, a nonprofit group in the state for people with disabilities. And we talked to her. She says that the GNETS model just isn't working.
The model is this. Kids go into these programs. They get good supports, and then they go back to their neighborhood school. Well, the way it works is, if you could picture this, let's say kids were getting good supports. From the audit and the letter of the finding, we know kids aren't. But let's say they were. Then you go back to your neighborhood school where these supports and services aren't available. Common sense that the kid's not going to do very well because the supports and services are not there. And kids end up back in GNETS.
Marianne, I think what we're hearing there is shades of old school Southern segregation, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that you mentioned in your intro that was so interesting was that some of these school buildings, these facilities, these run-down facilities, are the exact same ones that were being used in the Jim Crow era to house black students. And I just think that that's a stunning sort of factoid.
Yeah. Natasha Hall, you have a 10-year-old son in the GNETS program, as we mentioned earlier, with our last moment here. Tell us, how do you think that the system could have served your son better?
they could have definitely provided more support. Instead of throwing him immediately after what was on black and white, two incidents that were very minor, they could at least observed him. They could have collected data. They could have provided a parapro for him. Just things like that. But instead, he was always thrown into that type of environment. So right now, he knows nothing different. We've always been bused about 20 minutes or more to a whole other school outside of our area, period. So yeah. He doesn't know anyone. So just basic. So even helping him with social skills like that, letting him be involved with people, you know, everyday faces that he's going to see.
Natasha Hall speaking last year with Adam Ragusa. Adam also spoke with Marion Wang, who reported on problems with GNETs for ProPublica. In response to the Justice Department's lawsuit, Georgia School Superintendent Richard Woods released a statement. He said, quote, GNETs is a critical resource for the children it serves, many of whom would otherwise face isolation in residential treatment facilities. We are disappointed in the DOJ's decision to sue, especially given the tremendous efforts we've put into enhancing the educational experience for the small percentage of children who receive education services from GNETs programs. We believe these efforts are working, and we have communicated that to the DOJ. End quote. We'll continue to follow developments in this lawsuit. Meanwhile, the DOJ recently said it's reviewing another case, this one in Newton County, Georgia. As we reported Monday, plans for a mosque and cemetery there were put on hold because the county issued a moratorium on building permits for religious institutions. Now the county says it has lifted that moratorium. The man behind the planned cemetery and mosque is Imam Muhammad Islam of Doraville, Georgia. He told us last week his cemetery will be open to all faiths.
Our objective, you and me, everyone, if we want to live side by side, peacefully, obviously you got to look at me and I got to look at you. You got to take care of me, I got to take care of you. When someone comes from, somebody died, okay, if they come, so I'm going to see him, I'm going to talk to him. More I meet, more I talk, this fear and the doubt, okay, that will be gone.
Muhammad Islam also told us he will be willing to let other churches operate on the property he owns in Newton County. Georgia's HOPE scholarship program has helped nearly 2 million students pay for college since it began in 1993. That includes 98% of the University of Georgia's freshman class this fall. They're all either getting HOPE money or Zell Miller scholarships from the state. But a new report says HOPE could run out of money by 2028. That's the year that kids that are now in pre-K would start college. Nancy Bodisher wrote that report for the Committee to Preserve HOPE Scholarships. She also covered politics and education for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution for 16 years. Nancy, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So what will cause the HOPE Scholarship Program to run out of money?
I think it's a combination of factors. The program is incredibly popular, has been since its inception. Also, a factor is the rising cost of college, not just here in Georgia, but nationally.
So I said that it has helped 2 million students to get to college. Do we have sort of a breakdown of who those students are? How many of them may have not have been able to go to college if not for the HOPE Scholarship?
I don't believe that data is available, though it would certainly be helpful. But
yeah.
There, you know, I think it's pretty much been proven that it's been a cross section of the state. Most every county, there are some HOPE scholars, if I looked at the data. But in terms of the economics of who those are, that's a mixed bag.
Which means, Nancy, we don't actually know what the impact would be for sure. Would the HOPE Scholarship Program go away? Right.
You could say that on one point, but the larger point that we do know is that it did meet its mission of keeping some of the best and brightest in Georgia. As you mentioned in your opening, 98% of the students at UGA this fall will be on HOPE or Zell. And in that freshman class, the average GPA of a starting freshman is 3.9 out of a possible 4.0. So clearly it's raised standards.
Well, let's hear from a couple students. These students would not be affected. They're in high school now, so they're okay. But here's Kaylin Ware, a 17-year-old student at Decatur High School, saying if the HOPE Scholarship Program were to go away, she would have trouble getting to university.
I'd have to take out loans, and I don't want to spend my entire adult life paying back money that I could get easily, like through academic achievement.
And here's another one. This is Elena Ferguson, also 17 years old and also at Decatur High School.
Absolutely. That's kind of my key to college this year. I would be really disappointed. I would have to take out student loans, and I probably wouldn't be able to go to the college I wanted to go to.
So, Nancy, when we talk about the Hope Scholarship disappearing, and you said, well, part of the headline of this has been it's been too successful for its own good, but is it that there are more students getting and taking advantage of Hope Scholarships than we expected, or not enough revenue going into the program?
Well, again, it may be a little bit of a combination of both, but one of the issues that we found as we did our analysis is when the reforms were made in 2011, they created the Zell Miller Scholarship, which went to students who have a 3.7 GPA, obviously arguably the best of the best. But what we found out is that those students are also choosing to go to the most expensive schools, mainly UGA and Georgia Tech, right. So that's part of it, and that's what, as we run out the scenario in the years that, you know, to come, is that those students, more students will be trying to get that scholarship.
So I want to clarify here. The reason that makes a difference is because the Hope Scholarship is not a set dollar amount; it's just tuition.
Right, absolutely. It's strictly tuition. Initially, in the early years, it also covered books and student activity fees. But along with the other reforms that were made in 2011, those went away.
And what funds the Hope Scholarship Program?
It's strictly funded by the Georgia Lottery, which is arguably one of the most successful in the nation. But as all lotteries do, as they grow and age, their revenues can't continue to grow because there are a limited number of people who will buy the tickets.
So cost of attendance, I'm looking at Georgia Tech's cost of attendance for this school year, and the total per year, but this includes, although this includes books and supplies, is about $27,000. If you just break that down to the student fees and the tuition itself, then we're looking at maybe $12,000.
Right.
But multiplying that by 2 million kids, that is a heck of a lot of money. And we are expecting for your report, how did you calculate when the scholarship program might run out of money?
Well, we looked at how much money is currently being spent out of the lottery for all the education programs. And there's a number of them, of course, Hope, Zell Miller. There's also Hope grants for the technical school students, plus it also pays for Georgia Pre-K. So we took the amount of money currently being spent for each of those pots, and we walked it out and said, if nothing changes, what will happen to the money? Well, obviously, the largest number of students are in the Hope Scholarship, the 3.0 students. And so as we walk that out, the money for that starts to fall off in 2018 and then continues to drift down until 2028 when the program is out of money and in a deficit.
Did you anticipate that there would be more students? Did you calculate that the number of students taking advantage would grow?
Absolutely. Our forecasts, though admittedly conservative, estimate that the number of Miller scholars will grow 6% a year, and the number of Hope recipients will grow 2% a year, which, if you think about it, makes sense because obviously you want to shoot for getting the full tuition coverage, which is the Zell Miller Scholarship.
Let's hear another comment from one of our students. This is Elena Ferguson again, 17-year-old at Decatur High School, and she thinks that colleges are maybe too competitive with one another and should be focusing more on getting the students in and getting them degrees.
Maybe it should be less about the marketing and more about the fact that people need an education and people have a right to get an education in the United States. And everybody has a dream and it's their right to chase their dream.
Nancy, you covered politics and education for the AJC for 16 years or so. Can we say that the Hope Scholarship Program is achieving what it was meant to do? Is this an actual political state program that is functioning and succeeding?
I believe it is arguably the most popular and successful program that Georgia's had in my lifetime because, one, it kept more students, high-quality students, in Georgia for college, which then typically says they end up staying here at least for their first jobs, which is great for Georgia. Have the best brains be in Georgia. But it also changed the mindset about the hopes, about college and the opportunities that are out there. Students now, beginning in sixth grade, hear from their teachers and counselors about the value of hope and the value of a higher education, and that can only be a huge payoff.
How do we know what number of students would have left the state were it not for the Hope Scholarship?
I don't think I've seen any research, though there has been a number of research projects on this. I don't think anyone knows for sure who stayed, but they do know that at UGA, 20 years ago, you would not have had the freshman base with a 3.9 GPA. So at least from that anecdotal evidence, we say smarter kids are staying in state.
So what has to be done? If lottery funds are not enough to continue funding the Hope Scholarship, what are the alternatives?
I think the legislature needs to look at the many options that are out there. The Committee to Preserve Hope, the folks who hired me, back the idea of casinos and some of the proceeds going to help Hope and Georgia Pre-K. But also there's discussion about whether it needs to be a needs-based program or whether the General Assembly needs to pony up more money, say, to fund Pre-K, and so that would leave more money for Hope.
Is there no, I mean, if this is the most popular program that we have currently in the state, is there no possibility that there could be a millage or a bond or a statewide tax?
I guess any of that could be on the table. It took a constitutional amendment to get the Georgia lottery established. So I'm sure that's all options that legislature could look at.
Okay, so you did this report for, as we said, the Committee to Preserve Hope Scholarships. Did you have any trouble getting the information? How transparent was the data that you needed?
I had a lot of accessibility, really. Of course, partly because I knew the questions to ask because I've covered Hope since
for a very long time.
I was with Governor Miller at Underground Atlanta when he gave out the first lottery check. So I knew where to go. But I would say that folks know that the public wants to learn about the Hope Scholarship Program, and so they were I would say fairly open to me.
How and the timeline itself? What's the sense of urgency here? I mean, as I mentioned in the introduction to this interview, if Hope runs out at the time that your report suggests it may, runs out of money, that would affect the kids who are currently in pre-K. That means they're age 3 or 4 years old. That's a fairly good amount of time. That's 12 years. So what is the urgency here? How much time do we have to get a system in place in order to fund Hope to the level it needs to be funded?
Well, certainly there. That was one of the advantages of what we said is we were able to look out ahead because in 2011 when they made the changes, one of the folks who were a part of the architects of the changes said, we did this in 22 days. Well, a program that important does not need to undergo major changes in that short a time frame. So we hope that thoughtful discussion can begin now. So partly so there won't be any danger in 2028, but also so the parents of these first graders today can have some assurances that it will be there for their kids.
How much are you expecting tuition to rise over the next 12 years?
We used a forecast that says 7.5% a year, and that's based on a mix of the state data and the national data. Again, tuition is soaring
everywhere. But that compounds.
Everywhere.
If it goes up 7.5% next year, then it's 7.5% of that larger amount the year that follows. That's a compounding amount.
Absolutely. Tuition has gone up tremendously. As you mentioned, the numbers at Georgia Tech, the freshmen at UGA, you know, on their website it says to them, prepare to spend $25,000, $26,000 for 1 year of education. Now, that takes in tuition, also room and board and that kind of thing. But clearly, college is not going to get any cheaper.
Right. And in the minute that we have left, there are a number of factors that could affect this report since it is such a far view. In other words, political changes on the national level could also affect funding for universities and change that calculation as to the price of tuition.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, and we certainly acknowledge that in the report. But as with any forecast, we took the best information we have now and said, what if this continues? And then we went the extra step of asking three experts in the field of forecasting to take a look at our numbers, and they said they were not only on target, but potentially a little bit on the conservative side.
That is Nancy Bottischer. She wrote the report on the HOPE Scholarship Program for the Committee to Preserve HOPE Scholarship. She also covered politics and education for the AJC for 16 years. Nancy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Dragon Con kicks off tomorrow in downtown Atlanta. So if you see any orcs, elves, or anime characters walking around the city, do not be alarmed. The convention offers a wide variety of workshops and panels, but one of the biggest events on the schedule is always the annual Dragon Con parade. We have a preview here with sound from a past parade in this audio postcard.
My name is Lindsay Gray. I'm from Montgomery, Alabama. I am wearing a mask. I'm one of the ninja-type characters from Mortal Kombat. Frost from Mortal Kombat Deadly Alliance. Is very similar to Sub-Zero, but she was only in the one game, Deadly Alliance, whereas Sub-Zero is in all of the games. Dragon Con, I just love the party environment and just the laid-back atmosphere of it. And it is a lot different than Comic-Con, which is the biggest convention, but it's more corporate, whereas Dragon Con is fan-run. Since it's not corporate, everything's not like just, you know, cut and dry. That's my favorite part about this place.
My name is Simon. I'm from Atlanta. This costume is the Captain America Elite costume by Disguise Costumes. Obviously, I made a couple adjustments to it. I had to redo the belt because it really sucked. I had to redo the mask, which is still not what it should be, but it's getting there. The shield is also just a generic shield. I've spent 6 months preparing. And unfortunately, the 6 months that I spent making a Captain American cowl all failed, and I ended up wearing what I'm wearing right now. But that's how it goes.
My first Dragon Con was 1998. My name is Ken Beyer, and I'm from Northern Virginia. John Scalzi has a wonderful thing about the difference between hipsters and nerds. And a hipster is somebody who says, I love the XYZ coffee shop, but now everybody else has found out about it, and I hate it, and they've ruined it. And a nerd is somebody who says, you like Roman armor? I love Roman armor. Let's talk about Roman armor. The more people who love the thing you love, the better it is, not the worse.
Tens of thousands of book lovers will gather in Atlanta tomorrow for the Decatur Book Festival. It is the largest independent book festival in the country and runs through the weekend. Tomorrow we'll speak with some of the authors featured at this year's event. So what are some of your favorite books you've read over the past year, and is there a book that you couldn't put down? Tell us what it is at 404-500-9457, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Mercer University President Bill Underwood welcomed students last week with a reminder that schools are a place for intellectual freedom.
It's not the role of the university to shield you from ideas and opinions that you find disagreeable or even that you find deeply offensive. It is our role to help you learn how to engage productively with those with whom you disagree. And that's sometimes difficult.
That speech comes as a national debate over safe spaces and trigger warnings takes place on campuses across the country. Bill Underwood is my guest this morning. Welcome.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
This debate over safe spaces and trigger warnings has actually been going on for a few years on campuses. How do you maintain the balance between a university that says we won't have, say, hate speech, or a university that says you can't paint a swastika on your dorm room door, as opposed to something that is part of intellectual freedom?
Well, it is a difficult balance, and I'm glad you phrased the question that way, because, you know, there are some issues that arise that are relatively easy to think through and fit neatly within the kind of framework that I outlined the other day. And then there are tough issues that require a lot of thought. And sometimes after you make a decision, you think back on them later and think, you know, I'm not sure that was the right decision. It is a very difficult balance. Context matters a great deal.
So I want to put maybe some examples to you for the next few minutes and sort of test out where the limits of this are, if that's okay.
Sure.
First we go to one university where students are disciplined because they sang a song that included the N-word. Is something that's, you know, like the N-word, is that one of those clear, over the lines, not acceptable parts of speech?
Well, it depends on context, Celeste. When the N-word is being used, and the purpose for the use of it is to put down a group of people, then I think that is over the line. On the other hand, if you have a professor teaching history and the N-word is relevant to understand a moment in our history, then that's a different context and a different conclusion.
And that has also come up because there have been students at other schools that have demanded, say, that the schools don't teach Mark Twain or Huckleberry Finn, which makes use of the N-word. When it comes to literature, there seems to have been a lot of debate over this. You've got Yale students who said that they didn't want to be studying an English class in which they were all white male authors. That was for the major English poets, which, of course, focused on Chaucer and Shakespeare and Milton and Wordsworth. And then you had students at Seattle University who said their classical curriculum, which focused on Rome and Greece, was racist because it was focusing on people like Plato and Aristotle, who were, again, white guys. How do you answer complaints like that?
Well, I think, you know, making the complaints is fair and certainly something that can and should happen at universities, and making those observations about some of our courses and some of our literature, I think that kind of criticism is fair ground for debate. That doesn't mean the course isn't offered, but I think at the same time, allowing people to make that kind of observation is what universities are about.
So when you referenced ideas and opinions that students might find disagreeable or deeply offensive, who makes those decisions? Do all of those come to your office?
Well, that's part of the problem with those that frequently come to me and say, you know, we strongly disagree with this. What are you going to do about it? That puts one person in the role of being a sort of super censor. And I think, except in extreme circumstances, that's not a good solution. It's a much better solution to have a free market of ideas and let the ideas clash. And hopefully the best ideas ultimately prevail.
So then let me bring you to one of those, I guess, lines that universities sometimes straddle. This is a comment from Slate's chief political correspondent, Jamel Bowie, who says, "The conversation over free speech sometimes gets far away from the fact that minority students can feel unwelcome at predominantly white institutions." This is from an interview from last year.
I went to the University of Virginia. I am African American. UVA, when I went there, I think was about 9% African American. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I mean, I felt like I circumscribed my experience at the university. There are things I did not do in places I did not go because I just didn't have to deal with the possibility of being faced with a racial slur. Mm-hmm. And some people might see that and say, we just need to toughen up. But I would challenge someone who said that or who thought that to imagine what it would be like to be at a place that is functionally your home. This is your community. And you can't walk around and enjoy your community to its fullest because you're worried about someone using words which come with an implicit threat.
What is the difference between a conversation that's going on inside a classroom or laboratory, and it sounds like he's talking about conversations that are going on just on campus in general, in social situations, in cafeterias, etc.?
Well, I think we, all of us, have to be mindful of the fact that we are a community, and we don't want to be a community where some members of the community face slurs simply based on who they are. And that's one of the lines we draw.
So what is at stake here? We've had some academics say that universities, by honoring safe spaces and trigger warnings, are coddling college students. There's even a piece in The Atlantic called The Coddling of the American Mind. We had the incident at the University of Missouri in which a former communications professor was fired because she appeared on a viral video. What is at stake here?
Well, I think there are a number of things. I think certainly our capacity to pursue truth and understanding is at stake if we don't have a free and open environment. I also think our capacity to prepare these young men and women for the responsibilities of citizenship in a free society. I think that's at stake as well. That's at stake when we begin reining in legitimate debate on serious ideas. And we've got to be careful not to do that.
So you must have had conversations with a number of students. What do you think is sort of driving what appears to be a nationwide effort among students to control the messages they hear and the lessons they're taught?
Well, I haven't done the kind of empirical study I'd have to do to really reach a conclusion on causation. But I have a general sense that as our political environment has become more polarized, our campuses have as well. And I think that's led to more calls to restrain speech that people very strongly disagree with.
That is Bill Underwood. He is the president of Mercer University. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
The University of Georgia recently created two new fellowship programs to recruit the most promising graduate students. Those fellowships waive tuition and offer an annual salary of at least $20,000. Here to tell us more about that is Suzanne Barbour. She's the dean of the University of Georgia Graduate School. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning.
And money is not the only reason that college graduates go back to school or keeps them out of it, but it becomes an important factor once debt enters the picture. A study from the New America Foundation, which is a public policy think tank in Washington, D.C., found grad students owed an average $57,000 in debt in 2012, and that includes their undergraduate loans. So, Suzanne, how did you figure out what amount of money might be needed, especially in terms of the salary, to provide an affordable PhD or graduate degree for a student?
Yeah, a couple of things go into that calculation. You know, part of it is looking at graduate student debt, but quite frankly, another big part of it is positioning the University of Georgia so we can recruit and retain the most talented graduate students. Not everyone is aware, but graduate students actually play a major role in the way we do business here at the University of Georgia. They're an important part of our teaching mission, and they're a very, very important part of our research and scholarship mission, where essentially they're the fuel that drives that engine. And so when we compete for graduate students, we're not just competing locally or regionally. We're competing across the world, across the globe. And so we base those calculations in part on our ability to compete with other universities around the world for the most talented students.
And I assume that there was a return on investment calculation made, that in the end, offering a fellowship like this, even with an annual salary offered, made better business sense for the for University of Georgia.
Yes, again, absolutely. Our graduate students are the base of the pyramid that drives our scholarship engine. Research and development expenditures have gone up by nearly 21% at the University of Georgia over the last 2 years, and a good percentage of that can be devoted or designated to graduate student efforts. And so, again, the what we invest in our graduate students, they pay out to us tremendously in terms of the scholarship and the teaching that they do for the university.
Okay. To help us calculate the other end of that, the economics for the student, is Andrew Hansen. He's a senior analyst at Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce and co-authored a report called The Economic Value of College Majors. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Hi. So you just heard Suzanne explaining why this makes great sense for the University of Georgia. And if you get a fellowship, I would imagine that makes great sense for that student as well. But for most people, does the calculation work? For the people who go into debt of, say, $50,000 or $60,000, does that end up paying off?
It does end up paying off on average for most
people who pursue graduate degrees over the course of a 40-year career are going to make $400,000 more than people with bachelor's degrees. So we're talking about $2.2 million versus $1.8 million essentially over the course of your career. So it's a huge difference. It may take some time to get some of that back. But the other caveat to that is it really depends on what kind of graduate degree you're going to get. If you're going to get an education graduate degree, it probably does not make as much sense to take on that kind of level of debt. If you're going to get a degree in business or STEM, it definitely would.
Suzanne, is the university targeting certain programs or certain majors?
Yes, we are actually. So the two new award mechanisms we have are targeted, one at the doctoral level and the other at the master's level. And at the doctoral level, we're looking at those disciplines, many of them are STEM actually, that are essentially addressing global challenges that in turn are closely related to the strengths in our research mission. On the master's level, we're looking at disciplines that are underscoring the economy of the state of Georgia. And that's in things like aerospace, in transportation, in biotech, in informatics. And again, these are some of the same kinds of disciplines that are also disciplines where students get a large return for their investment on the investment they make in their graduate education.
Andrew, how fast does that change? In other words, does a major in aerospace, which might pay off today, would that have not paid off 2, 3, 4 years ago?
The broader categories do not change. So if you looked 10 years ago, the degrees that paid off the most were still STEM, business, and healthcare. However, within those degrees, there are specific types of engineering that yield a higher return within a smaller time frame. So for example, when we had a massive energy boom here in the United States, starting in 2010, the demand for petroleum engineers skyrocketed, and even fresh out of college were making more than $100,000 a year. So that does happen, but the broader differences that we see between, for example, STEM, business, education, social services, those stay relatively consistent over the course of decades.
So, Suzanne, does this fellowship program allow the university to attract not just competitive students, but also a larger diversity? Does it make it possible for someone who may not have the means otherwise to get a PhD?
Yes, absolutely. You know, graduate students, unlike undergraduates, have more complicated lives. They're adults. Many of them have homes and they have mortgages. They have car payments. They have children themselves that they're putting through school. And so their ability to come back to school and continue their education very much depends on their ability to be supported. On top of that, there's been a prediction that there'll be a 6.4% increase in jobs requiring the graduate degree in the state of Georgia. So this is clearly serving a need for the citizens of the state of Georgia and positioning them to be more competitive in the workforce.
Andrew, does having more PhDs make the national economy stronger? Do we have a national interest in getting higher education to more people?
Absolutely. We've released an analysis just a few months ago where we looked at the trends in the post-recession jobs recovery. The economy's added almost 9 million jobs for college graduates. 4 million of those have gone to people with graduate degrees. So the payoff is higher than ever. We've seen enormous growth, especially for folks with graduate degrees in fields like management consulting, finance, IT, and engineering, and healthcare as well. So these are trends that are becoming starker over time. More than 90% of the jobs that we've added in the post-recession jobs recovery have gone to people with either bachelor's or graduate degrees. So this is, a very stark trends in the economy that we're seeing.
Suzanne, we only have about 30 seconds left, but how many fellowships are available each year?
So there are 10 fellowships for the doctoral and there are 10 fellowships for the master's. We view this as a very competitive program.
That's a pretty ambitious for a beginning program. Suzanne Barbour is Dean of the University of Georgia Graduate School. Andrew Hansen is Senior Analyst at Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. Suzanne and Andrew, thank you both so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.